Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on March 26, 2019. This is the ninth week of our Tuesday 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Sambodhi Sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So tonight we're going to begin 3 weeks on the three marks of existence. And then in the book, and in this time through, the next 2 or 3 weeks are going to be on dependent origination and the five clinging aggregates. So in essence, these 5 or 6 weeks are really on one subject, and it's understanding dukkha. Because the three marks of existence are included in dukkha, and it really is just different characteristics. In other words, it's because of an impermanent environment that we live in that we try to establish a permanent self in, can't be done, that leads to and develops suffering, disappointing experiences in our life. So those three are intertwined, and the insight that is gained through the Buddha's Dhamma is very specific to those three marks of existence and ultimately to the nature of suffering and our own contribution to that. The reason why I'm making that distinction is that one of the major modern Buddhist schools is the Vipassana school, or the Vipassana movement that started in Burma many, many years ago. And actually the reason why Ledi Sayadaw started it was to introduce a singular meditation method that government employees would employ that wasn't so complicated that, in his mind, they had to develop a religion, meaning everything that the Buddha taught. So it was already a hybridized, Vipassana was already a hybridized school of Buddhism. And the insight that's taught is a very general and broad insight that's taught under that that umbrella of the insight Buddhist movement. And again, the Buddha didn't teach a very broad type of insight. He taught a very specific insight into these three marks of existence, into the impermanence of all things. And the not-self characteristic, and he uses the word that was common during his time, anatta, but he used it in a completely contradictory way than the word was used then. And even the modern interpretations get it wrong in relation to what the Buddha taught. The Buddha used the word anatta that historically meant not a supreme being. Atta would be, in the Hindu parlance, atta is God or the higher being or the creative force in the universe. Anatta is a conjunction that's saying it's not me, not God. And that has taken on translations, misunderstood translations, to say no such thing as a self. In other words, the translation would be anatta means no self. And that's led to the almost universal belief that the Buddha teaches that there's no such thing as a self, that the self is simply a mirage or an illusion. And that's completely false. The Buddha never taught that. He taught to understand self. So he used that term anatta to say that the views that we're holding of a self are wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's the views are wrong. They don't constitute a self. They're not a self. That's what anatta means as far as the Buddha is concerned, or the Buddha's Dhamma is concerned. And it's because of a misunderstanding of impermanence and the not-self characteristic that we create suffering in our lives. But there's also many suttas where the Buddha says impermanence itself is suffering. A misunderstanding of self is suffering. When we get into, in 4 or 5 weeks, depending on our schedule, to the five clinging aggregates, we're going to get deeper into this notion of not self. But the Buddha's description of the ongoing personal experience of suffering, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is the five clinging aggregates. Each one of those aggregates is impermanent. And we're gonna look at these in slightly different ways than we have in the past. As important as the three marks of existence, somebody asked this question, that's why I'm talking about this now, an online student. As important as the three marks of existence are, there's no sutta that is called the impermanent not-self dukkha sutta. But in nearly every sutta, the Buddha addresses those, and no other, there's no aspect of human life that the Buddha teaches that we should be gaining insight into except those three things. And that's why I keep coming back to put our focus is on gaining insight into the three marks of existence. So this Sambodhi Sutta is something that you read most of this past week in preparation for this course. But it fits perfectly into where we are. And again, just to cap that, we started with a teaching on proper meditation and the use of shamatha vipassana meditation. Then we looked at the Buddha's teachings on how to meditate and the four foundations of mindfulness, and then how to apply an ever-deepening level of concentration to different themes of the Dhamma, always including the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which, you know, that's refined mindfulness. And then we looked at proper application of an integration of the Eightfold Path so as to give proper insight into these three marks. And that's where we are today. The Buddha was at Anathapindika's monastery at Jeta's Grove. He asked those gathered, "Friends, if those of other sects would ask you what are the prerequisites for developing the wings of self-awakening, how would you respond?" The monks and the nuns asked the Buddha to tell them his response so that they would remember it clearly. "Listen closely then. The prerequisites for developing the wings to self-awakening are here for you," meaning they're available for every human being. There's nothing special about the Buddha's Dhamma. And I'm sure that was a very inspiring thing for people to hear, especially women and people in the lower classes, because they were always taught that the wings to self-awakening are not available to you. You're not of the right class. You can't have these. He's making this profound and radical statement that what I'm teaching is for everyone. And that simply was unheard of during the Buddha's time. You didn't teach women and you didn't teach people the so-called undesirables. They weren't allowed to learn anything, much less something as important as a Dhamma. The first is having admirable friends and companions. It's interesting that the Buddhists, again, put ourselves back into this time frame, 2,600 years ago. The Buddha was emphasizing the importance of having admirable friends. And we know from the different suttas, I can't think of the one that comes to mind, Anuradha Sutta, that admirable friends means having friends and associations that are actually developing the Dhamma. And it is those wise associations that form the basis for a well-informed Sangha. So it doesn't mean, admirable friends doesn't mean just having friends that are admirable in some way. They're admirable because they've integrated the Dhamma. Remaining virtuous and restrained and understanding the danger of even the slightest faults. And it also relates to admirable friends, doesn't it? Hearing easily sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. Hearing talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and the knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. I would say that kind of really governs our talks and discussions here, doesn't it?
What did you mean by that word easily, hearing easily?
That you're in a situation where you'll easily hear it. In other words, you're not expecting you're not going down to Frank's Tavern to hear Dhamma talk, because you're not going to easily hear it there. Oh. Unless I happen to be tending bar, then you might hear it. A shot of awakening, please. But yeah, again, if I'm associating myself in a so-called spiritual group that doesn't talk about the Dhamma, and I know it, I'm not likely to easily hear Dhamma talk. And so that's clear guidance on, and again, it doesn't mean that I shouldn't go bowling with my friends on Friday night. But if I'm expecting to learn and integrate the Dhamma, I do it through wise associations. And if you look at the overall subject, how does associating with people that understand the Dhamma is establishing a strong foundation in the midst of everything that is impermanent? And the reason why I'm saying that is if you go back and you look at the, how do I say this without sounding, I don't want to be sound denigration, denigrating to other If you go to almost any major Buddhist site and see what they're into right now, it's going to be the current Buddhist thought of the day, whatever it might be. And that's always changing because it's always influenced by whatever people want to call Buddhist practice. What the Buddha is saying that is a well-focused Sangha remains focused on these timeless truths. There's no change. So since there's no change in that.
And there's no debate about it.
And there's no debate because this is what it is.
Everything is impermanent.
No, it's an important question that comes up. The within this framework of all things impermanent, there's a timeless past to understand that. So rather than fixate the teachings as an object that we can solidify, there's simply something that has the right word. I can't.
Well, it's like it's a stream. It's a stream of knowledge that's come down. A stream's changing all the time, through time. And in that stream, that's been, you know, the root, which is the Sutta Pitaka.
Yeah, I guess the easiest way to say this is impermanence relates to all the things in the world that are impermanent that I attach myself to describe myself to myself and to the world, that I use to make myself. Do I make another anatta, a confused human being that doesn't understand its environment and creates suffering? But the knowledge that brings that understanding is timeless, and it persists throughout the impermanent nature of the world we live in. It's not a contradiction just to say, oh, well, everything is impermanent, but how about this? Because it doesn't relate to the problem of impermanence. It's simply a teaching of an awakened human being. And it's a mind, and I'm not saying you did this, Bonnie, it's a mind that, you think about the very broad but very specific teaching that the Buddha gave. And a mind that is insistent on continuing to ignore its own ignorance will do everything it can to find something wrong in it. And it'll find, perhaps, and in any situation, you know, you can find one thing wrong that doesn't apply in every single situation. Say, okay, what's this saying? I'll throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because you're looking at it in a way to find fault in it rather than simply develop it. And that's rather common, too. You know, it's what the Mahasanghikas did at the Second Buddhist Council, going back 2,400 years now. They wanted it to be different, so they made it different. Yeah. But it's an important question. Thank you. Remaining persistent for abandoning unskillful mental qualities and for developing skillful mental qualities. Resolute in right effort. You remember that in last week when we talked about different aspects of right effort and how the Buddha included that. And recognizing when we're engaged in unskillful or hurtful behavior so that we can abandon it, not analyze it, not massage it, not embrace it, recognize it and abandon it. And just as important to recognize the teachings of the Buddha that we must incorporate into our Eightfold Path practice in order to awaken. Just as important to know what to develop as it is to know what to abandon. Furthermore, for one developing the wings to self-awakening, they would maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. In other words, recognize it, it's working. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will be virtuous and restrained, seeing danger in even the slightest faults. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected they will hear sober talk and talks conducive to gaining understanding. They will hear talks on modesty, contentment, the value of seclusion and quiet, non-entanglement, persistence, virtue, concentration, discernment, and knowledge of true vision and release from craving and clinging. When one has admirable friends and companions, it is expected that they will maintain discernment and understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. Maintain an understanding of impermanence and the cessation of stress. It points us right back to the Eightfold Path. Once these qualities are developed, there are four more to develop. Contemplation of what is unattractive so as to abandon craving. Goodwill should be developed so as to abandon ill will. Mindfulness of the breath in the body should be developed so as to develop non-distraction or concentration. They should develop understanding of impermanence. I'm going to go back to the beginning. They should develop understanding of impermanence so as to uproot conceit and further eye-making. Understanding impermanence, and this relates directly to the five clinging aggregates as well. Understanding the nature of impermanence uproots conceit. It uproots eye-making. As Lao Tzu said, when one understands the impermanence of all things, we let go of everything. In relation to the Buddha's Dhamma, once we understand the impermanence of things that we used to attach ourselves to and join ourselves with, we'll simply let go of it. We'll be free of clinging. And ultimately, it's clinging to views ignorant of Four Noble Truths or clinging to wrong views that create all the suffering in our life. So understanding the nature of impermanence. Someone asked, it might have been Nick, who's here right now. Nick, you might have asked this question a couple weeks ago in relation to this. So how do you engage in this practice of recognizing and abandoning impermanence? When you're looking at yourself and you're feeling caught up in the world, and you can do this at any time, how do you know that? When your mind is agitated, the simple solution to that agitated mind state is to become mindful of the breath in the body and remind yourself that this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. That relates directly to also to the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the third sutta the Buddha ever gave and the first he ever gave on the not-self characteristic. When we start recognizing and abandoning self-referential views, clinging to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, we begin to stop the process of constant eye-making, or conceit as a translation here. Is that clear? Yes. And so is it clear to everyone how the three marks of existence are intertwined in a way that we can say that dukkha, impermanence and the not-self characteristic is an aspect of dukkha. And the experience of impermanence and the not-self characteristic is ongoing dukkha or ongoing disappointment. Is that clear?
Say that again, please.
In the ongoing experience of dukkha, disappointment, unsatisfactoriness, is included impermanence and not-self. Another way of saying that is because of a misunderstanding of the impermanent environment that we live in, just as a consequence of having a human life, we're in an impermanent environment. All things are impermanent. And a misunderstanding of self that compels us to define a self permanently based on impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas, it creates stress. Just because it can't be done. I mean, ultimately, that's the reason why we're attempting to do something that is completely impossible, which is to create a self out of ignorance. And think about that for a little bit. Anything that we try to create out of ignorance is going to, at some point, prove to be disappointing, isn't it? No matter what it is. You can't pick a subject that you can say, I can be ignorant about and master it, and it'll bring me happiness. Because suffering is inherent in ignorance, isn't it? Well, and this will get, and I'm kind of leading us into our next exposition of dependent origination, but that's how the Buddha, that's what the Buddha awakened to. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of suffering arises. And as you take yourself through the 12 links of dependent origination, included in there is impermanence and the creation of the not-self characteristic. From craving comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. This is a sixth and seventh, maybe, or eighth, and dependent origination. Becoming what? This points directly back to where I started. Every human life, moment by moment, is an example of what am I going to become. And if I'm holding in mind a well-integrated Eightfold Path, then I can become awakened. If not, if all I'm holding in is and holding on to and clinging to is ignorance, the next moment in my life, I can only, the only potential there is to become further ignorant. That's a direct and immediate experience of impermanence, isn't it? Does everybody get that? Or the ever-changing nature of all things. If it wasn't for impermanence and we found ourselves rooted in ignorance, there'd be no way of changing that because everything is permanent. However, I find myself in this moment. So impermanence is, in one sense, the problem, but it's also to be appreciated as the possibility to change the way I'm thinking right now. I can go from wrong view to right view, the Eightfold Path. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but don't you have to understand the one to get the other?
You have to understand, actually, the three. You have
well,
to
I'm talking about the three marks of it. You have to understand when you're caught in that mind frame of you're looking at the world through permanence and then the suffering that ensues to be able to understand what impermanence is. It's through the suffering that you're going to find the awakening.
Well, yeah, and but understanding impermanence does not necessarily take a lot because it's obvious. The problem with it, the obvious nature of it, is just that we tend to overlook it. We can't see the forest for the trees because we're in it. But again, that's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, because it's not, it's simple, it's what we're living, it's right in front of us. But because we have a mind that is rooted in ignorance of the way things are, cannot see the forest for the trees. It can't see it clearly because it doesn't have a reference for it. The Eightfold Path provides the reference for recognizing the simple fact of impermanence in our life.
Today I realized, you know, trying to keep the Eightfold Path in mind in daily life and knowing when I'm in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, realized that that was wrong view, that being in right view is the Four Noble Truths.
Yes, and the awakened understanding of that is, of the experience of understanding impermanence, is that each and every moment we have united our mind and our body with our life as our life occurs. And so we're living in the midst of impermanence, but it no longer affects us because we're simply in the continuum of our own mindful presence. But when I start attaching myself to things that are permanent, such as just an idea, you know, just whatever that idea might be, tomorrow I'm going to acquire something that will make me a better person. Well, okay, you've lost a moment, haven't you? And I'm not talking about learning a little bit more of the Dhamma, you know, maybe getting a new hat or something, whatever it might be, whatever embellishment I'm trying to apply to myself because I'm not good enough in this moment is the distraction. But understanding that I am in a constant state of becoming myself, that leads me to hold in mind principles that allow me to maintain a peaceful and calm mind in the midst of everything being impermanent. Is that clear? Did I just make a simple thing more complicated? Is everybody getting this?
Yeah.
We're nibbling
at it. Well, and again, I think it's such a simple and it's so close that it's hard to see it. And a self-referential ego self so wants to be established no matter what. Even hearing the words of the Buddha, there's still a, yeah, but what happens to me? Nothing happens. Because nothing can happen. Because there's nothing there. It's like foam on the ocean. If you want something to really happen, take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because there it is. And each and every moment, each and every moment has its own reward simply because we're present for it. We don't need to add anything to what's occurring to me right now. Because whatever I could add is like foam on the ocean. It's impermanent. I can't create anything of any value out of it. So, if it's impermanent, it can't be me. How could it?
So, John, I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, when we hold on, like when you hold on to the ignorance because you think that's what you know, you cling and you crave, you keep things the way they were. hear the word fear coming up, because I think that sometimes, you know, you become fearful that in letting go, or if I stop thinking like this, just even for a minute or 5 minutes, to try to experience a different intention when you're experiencing something that just comes at you because of the impermanence of bing, bang, bong, one, two, you know, things right after the other. So how does the Dhamma kind of talk about fear, if they do?
Oh, yeah.
Any kind of...
Fear is an agitated mind state, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so, and there's a few different ways of dealing with it. Right there, it tells me that I'm stuck in eye making. How could I be fear? And this isn't the kind of fear. I think it was our first retreat when I was talking about the not self characteristic, and somebody just put this out there. I think they were trying to make me look a little foolish, but they said, "Well, if there's no such thing as a self, what do you do when you're standing on a train tracks and a train is coming at you, expecting me to be caught up? Why you take two steps to the right? You know, get out of the way. This has nothing to do with that." And in fact, that's kind of an...
That's not what I mean.
But that's where that kind of thinking can go to. The I kind of lost my train of thought.
I'm implying that we get to the point where we know, even if you see, you know that this is something you have an opportunity to do differently, to let go, stop clinging to... or be, you know, the conditioned behavior, doing what you did, that I think, so he's applying, or the Dhamma's applying the agitated state of mind that would be a fearful state.
It certainly can be, and it's an understanding where the fear comes from that brings the understanding. And the Loka Sutta, and I use that sutta a lot, where the Buddha, the Loka Sutta is where the Buddha just awakened, and he's declaring, I looked out on the world for the first time, and the world is a flame. Flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion. And then further on in that sutta, he said that ignorance gives rise to desire. Desire brings fear, always. And think about that for a little bit. Well, if I'm fearful of something, it's because I'm afraid I'm going to lose something that I'm desiring, that I feel like I need to be happy.
Unless it's skillful desire.
Unless it's chanda. But we're not talking about that, because skillful desire wouldn't lead to fear, would it? So again, when an agitated mind state is a clear signal that, and let me use I'm having trouble coming up with the right word. When I'm stuck in fear, I'm stuck in eye making. And so when I incorporate the Eightfold Path, I understand what I'm supposed to do when I realize that I'm stuck in eye making. I'm supposed to take a breath and recognize, wait a minute, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And so in a very practical way, the fear might be, I'm afraid I'm going to have a confrontation with that coworker tomorrow, and I start getting agitated about it and playing a scene out in my mind about what they're going to say to me and what I might say to them, especially if I lose, blah, 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 blah. Well, you've lost your mind, haven't you? But rather than figuring out a way to reconcile the whole scenario, which you can't because you already wrote the story in your mind, simply recognize the eye making in it.
And fear also pulls you into the future, so...
Always.
It's a clear signal by your choice of words, your behavior, what's in your head, mm-hmm. that you're not present.
But it's also, I think, established in the past, because it leads you to not want to let go of the things that you know were. So particularly also,
fear is finding fault with the future, but we find fault with the future because we're dragging the past into the present, and it's pushing us. I mean, do you see how that type of thinking takes you immediately out of your body, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And it creates stress.
Exactly.
So it's not that stress created fear. I mean, and it's kind of a vicious circle, but fear created the stress.
Right.
And reacting to the stress then creates more fear.
Mm-hmm.
And reacting to that can lead to 2 bottles of vodka, a good snort of cocaine, a weekend of sex, a lot of golf, a lot of shop. Do they still have a shopping club on TV? I mean, it can lead to, I'm using all these different things that we use to deal with fear and that type of reactive mind state, rather than understand it's not happening to me, except that I'm doing it to me. And I'm stuck in a mind state that's creating fear and anxiety that I think is real, but it's all rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. There's no incidental fear to an awakened human being. That's not the right word, incidental, because it could be a train coming at you and you got to get out of the way. There's no self-created fear in an awakened human being. And I would say there's no self-created fear in someone who's developed a good portion of the Eightfold Path, meaning integrated it well. Fear only can arise from me thinking that something unrealistic. And again, if I'm standing on a train track, a train's coming out, I'm going to take 2 steps to the right. But I don't lose my mind anymore about thinking what terrible things might happen to me or what I might lose. And honestly, to think about that, personally, I haven't thought about losing anything in a long, long time.
No, I just had a major confrontation with my son. And at some point, I was getting afraid that there would be physical violence. And it took me quite a while to get out of that fear. Because I kept playing the scenarios in my head.
Yeah.
And while I was in my fearful state, all the scenarios went from bad to worse. And
yeah.
It took me almost an hour of trying to calm myself down to finally see that I was starting to act out of not just fear, but out of anger.
Mm-hmm.
And once I saw that, then I started coming up with ways out of the situation that did not involve anger. And I finally started realizing that I had to look at the situation from his point of view.
Yeah.
And his experience in it. But that was that, that fear was steering my thoughts for quite some time.
Yes, and you applied what you've learned, and I would say in a fairly short while you regained control of your mind.
Yeah.
That's how the Dhamma should work. I mean, it'd be nice if you didn't get to that one point, but it's remarkable that you're able to do that. I mean, it really is. I'm not just saying that. That's really the point of what we're doing, isn't
right.
it? So you don't go so far that you lose your mind and you beat up your son or whatever might happen.
Right.
You know?
Or get beaten up.
Or get beaten up, yeah. I didn't want to say that.
More like it.
And it's just such a practical example of how mm-hmm. this works. And so even though it was an unpleasant situation, I'm sure for Ari too,
mm-hmm.
it didn't lead to something else.
Yes.
Yeah. That's remarkable.
But it got close.
Well, it's important to recognize how close it got too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But...
and then later I started actually really applying the Dhamma and saying, okay, where is my anatta in this, where am I holding on to a view of myself? And the whole
and it became pretty obvious, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the parental authority thing came up. There it is.
Thank you. It's so important. That's how it works. And Bonnie, did this address what you were bringing up about fear?
Yeah, and I think if then I'm listening to this, it's like, so we fabricate all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
this,
yeah.
and that it compounds the
yep.
fearful state. And
oh, and it continues to feed that until we have some vehicle, the Eightfold Path, to recognize what we're doing.
So to employ the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Or to talk with someone who's on the same wavelength. So, but also, I guess, to the really, I don't want to say cool thing, but the phenomenal thing about it is that the recognition of, like, that in the moment of the anger, like Ron, you're talking about, you know, something where you really, I have to look at, you know, my fear, my anger, or my whatever, whether it be based on the tiger in front of you or the fabricated.
Right, the healthy fear.
Or
as
the
opposed to the fabricated
stuff that you turn a situation into bad. I think, you know, it's so phenomenal how everything is connected. So it's the fear that's connected to the fabrication. It's also connected to the restraint that we have to engage in so that you don't become impulsive,
mm-hmm.
so that, you know, until you can think it to, you know, view and consider all those steps.
Yeah, but that mindset that you're just describing, that becomes more and more automatic the more you integrate the Eightfold Path. In the beginning, we're just like, it's just like any other subject that we're learning. And so we apply it in ways that maybe we're not even really all that sure about. Until we do it a few times.
But some things are not so connected to us, like if we're learning math or history, you know, this involves the core of ourselves, of who we
yeah.
are, to be able to take that risk. To
yeah, but you know, in a subtle way,
the way you used to do, you know, do bite into this.
The best way to learn arithmetic is to go out and buy 3 apples, and then add 3 oranges, and add your. I mean, in a practical, what I'm saying is you first learn in school how to count to 3, but it doesn't do you any good until you take it and go out and buy 3 apples with it. The Dhamma is the same way. We first,
it, you mean.
Yes,
yeah.
we learn it until I mean, that's what we're doing in class here. This is, you know, we do it
same
every week.
With fractions.
Yep. And so we're learning our fractions right here. So when the situation arises and our son who's out of control is in our face, we don't lose control as well. We live in the world as an awakened human being. I mean, that's it. It almost sounds like, is that even worth it? But in the moment, that was the most valuable thing you could do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Rather than either get beat up or beat up your son.
Uh-huh. Right.
And so peace prevailed in that moment.
And not
if that could be applied in a global way, and there's no reason why it can't, except not enough people are doing it. This is why I say the most loving thing I can do for myself and all others is to take to the Dhamma. So I stop beating up my son and justifying it because he
and
got me so angry or whatever else it might be.
It's not just what the consequences for me would be, but in I saw very quickly that the consequences for him would have been way worse.
Oh, yeah.
Even if he had beaten me up.
Yeah.
That would have.
And they'd have to live with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everything the Buddha teaches, including this tonight, is practically applied. And we can live a life without fear. Constantly, until it's appropriate, you know. I mean, it's remarkable. That's kind of the understanding of these 3 marks of existence leads to the ending of fear, also, because what is there to fear? There's what could I, you know? Let me finish the sutta. Great discussion. For one who understands impermanence, clinging to the not-self characteristic, clinging to anatta, to not-self, is abandoned. For when one understands impermanence, clinging to not-self is abandoned. The Buddha said that 2,600 years ago. It's the whole point of the Dhamma. When he describes an awakened human being, the quality of their mind, he describes that as calm. And the overarching environment of the mind is unbound. Unbound from ignorance, unbound from clinging to views rooted in ignorance of 4 noble truths, unbound from believing that anything can be permanent about me. Understanding not self uproots conceit or I making. Unbinding arises in this moment. It's a pretty profound statement, isn't it? Kind of the whole point of what it is the whole point of if the whole point of our Dhamma practice is to unbind, how do we get there? The Buddha just taught us understanding not self uproots conceit, unbinding arises in this moment. The line before that, for one who understands impermanence, clinging to anatta, to not self is abandoned. So again, do you see the point of tonight's talk and the point of the not self characteristic or the three marks of existence is that they're all kind of this one ball of dukkha. And if we want to end it, we recognize and abandon clinging to all impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. I think that's it. And when one and when one has seen the five clinging aggregates as they really are, this is the Arahant Sutta, but I'll conclude it with that. The arising and the passing away, understanding the attraction and the distraction, seeing the arising of desire and the continued delusion, and being delivered from the five clinging aggregates, this one is released from clinging. All defilements are destroyed. What must be done has been done. Perfection is attained. The burden of not self or wrong views, has been put down. The highest goal attained. This one is liberated by perfect insight. Perfect insight. Thank you. Again, I've asked this question a few times. Are the three marks of existence a little bit more clear, mm-hmm. and the purpose of understanding them more direct?
Yes.
Good. Mm-hmm. We can all go home now. But let's go around the room first. I'm going to start with Jane. Jane, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, John?
I'm good. How'd you like tonight's talk?
It's the more I'm able to understand and embrace impermanence, the more peace I'm finding.
Isn't it remarkable? Yeah, it is. Such a simple thing. I'm sorry, Jane, I interrupted you.
No, I said it's life-changing. I mean, it's...
It really is, yeah. Well, I'm glad you joined. Nick, how are you tonight? Oh, wait a minute. There.
Okay.
There you go. How are you, Nick?
I'm not too bad. How are you today?
I'm good. What did you get out of tonight's talk?
I'm listening carefully to the talk, and I'm working towards understanding. I look at a point here. Buddha says you should associate with admirable friends, right? And he doesn't say with the exception of all others, but he says associate with admirable friends. And I think that associating with people that are not admirable friends gives you enlightenment as to what you should be doing to improve your association with the Dhamma, but also, and I haven't seen it in the books, in my reading so far, shouldn't you also be trying to influence people that are not associated, and are not associated with the Dhamma?
In a general way, no, we're not. But there's nothing, in other words, we're not supposed to be evangelists about what the Buddha teaches. What the Buddha's talking about with admirable friends means mostly with our Dhamma practice, that the people that we associate with as part of Dhamma practice be admirable, meaning that they be focused on the Buddha's teachings themselves as well, and not into all kinds of other things.
Well, so I understand that.
So and of course, just as a practical way, who we associate with is important too. We don't want to be, we don't want to be hanging around with bank robbers or, you know, people of ill repute, as they used to say. But in a general way, that everything the Buddha teaches is about his Dhamma. He doesn't teach, how to set up governments or how to build a school or anything like that. He's just concerned about the Dhamma. So when he's teaching something, it relates directly to the Dhamma, including this, about having admirable friends. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, I think it's impossible to develop the Buddha's Dhamma when you're trying to incorporate many other practices into it. I just don't think it works, so that I don't teach that. But that's the important distinction there, Nick. I'm glad you joined us tonight.
Thank you.
Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. As we mentioned last week, that ignorance is automatic. It is the condition that is there all the time. So
yeah.
when we're in fear or anger or any of those kinds of things, automatically it's about us. It's about me. So like in that last paragraph there, understanding impermanence, anatta is, I can't remember the exact thing, but something about understanding impermanence. Uproots conceit. Understanding anatta, unbound, is now.
Yep.
So when we feel something in our bodies happening now, in ignorance, we will label it fear. And now I am afraid. Now there's a story. Now there's a scenario. Now there's a whole history and future. We're lost. We're gone in ignorance. It's done. So we're out of our bodies, basically. So what happened first was a feeling. Sensation arose in the body somewhere. We move right past it and went into labeling it, into needing it to know what it is. That initial movement was away from what was occurring in the body now and into a story about what's occurring. Do you see the difference between those things?
But I have a little...
And it's happening in impermanence.
Right.
Yes, but what arises, we have to acknowledge, right? To acknowledge what it needs us to know so that it can, we can, but that requires employing a view and effort.
I'd say again, the condition of ignorance is automatic. So we're in ignorance going, this is fear, now I'm afraid, now... So, fabrications. It's fabricated. And now we're reacting to fabrications outside of what's occurring now in the body. So, when we understand impermanence, conceit ends. Anatta is over. So, what's occurring in the body now is just a feeling arising somewhere. It's not fear, it's not anger, it's not worry, it's not any of those things. It's just a sensation that's arising and passing away on its own somewhere in the body.
And it doesn't need the label of fear, except
the label
that we put on it.
It's a completely impersonal event.
Right, but it doesn't happen in a vacuum. And
no.
There's also someone on the other side of that that's also reacting.
Totally.
Know, and having impermanence.
Totally.
You know, and then it continues.
Definitely.
Right, but it doesn't only have to be fear. There are other things that
arise.
Anything. And so
any reaction, maybe, any reaction in the mind.
Any disturbance in the mind.
Right.
And so the Buddha taught four foundations of mindfulness to overcome that, to recognize that first we connect with our breath, then we recognize that feelings arising and passing away are just feelings arising and passing away. You remember in the Satipatthana Sutta, where those are pretty much the exact words. Thoughts arising and passing away are thoughts arising and passing away. It's only the value that we put on that, evaluating them from the reference point of a fabricated view, that we create difficulties with those situations. And so, and getting back to that example that Ram used with his son, at some point, he immediately practiced restraint when he realized he wanted to strangle the young guy. And so he didn't. And he allowed himself to work through that to the point where he could let go of even the initial fear and anger. That's the power that the Dhamma brings you. That's what Matt's describing. So rather than reacting always out of fear and anger, we recognize it's just something impermanent. And recognize the impermanence in the fear right now uproots the reaction. It uproots
but without
conceit.
Recognition, without viewing it, you tend to stay in that old place.
Well, I think...
Have a good night.
Good to see you both.
Good night. I think recognizing it, there's two things. There's becoming aware of sensation arising in the body, and then there's fabricating a recognition of something that's a word or a label or a scenario or a story,
an evaluation.
That's not the same as
an analysis.
Right.
Which is often, not always, but often analysis is trying to place some blame on something.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is simply further eye-making.
Exactly.
Whether it's on myself or on a situation or on a person.
And this thing, like Frank said, you know, this is in real time and in relationship.
But wait, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I got to... There's a difference between, and maybe this is where you're coming from, Bonnie. This is not meant to be therapy, but in a therapeutic setting... It would be appropriate to look at the fear and analyze it in that right context. This is just something different than that.
Sure.
And
sure.
So.
I get this in the same context of the Four Noble Truths.
Yes.
Right. And in that way, you know, with what Frank said, in real time, in relationship with the example that Ram gave, again, this is the Buddha teaches a Dhamma to practice. Mm-hmm. So, this you can't do that unless you practice.
Right.
Practice
and
practice makes
in the world.
Right.
You have to
practice so that this capacity is developed, so that when your own flesh and blood is coming to kill you, or something. You know, being a little dramatic here, but then there's a deep well to draw on.
Right.
So it's not
in real time.
In real time. Mm-hmm. In real time. So, you know.
But using this as a framework
is how you develop that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just like Ram was describing that. Yeah. It's for most of us, it's not automatic. The first time we read about the Eightfold Path, and you know, we never have any fear left anymore. It usually takes situations that we incorporate it appropriately, that we learn and let go of fear.
See, you do it incorrectly.
Yeah, but
unskillfully,
right.
And then maybe next time a little more skillfully,
yeah.
Or a pause, or a recognition earlier in the process.
It's just that way. And we keep doing it. You know, this is, as modern Dhamma practitioners, this is what we do. If we want to do something else, we could do that. And what I'm saying is, if we want to be people that have a Dhamma practice of walking meditation, we might follow Thich Nhat Hanh more closely. You know, and that's fine. But you're not going to find anything in walking meditation or the underlying philosophy that addresses fear or anger or anything else or any type of eye making. You know, that again, it's just something completely different. And so the Buddha teaches us how to recognize the eye making that's an inherent part of a misunderstanding of impermanence and causes suffering in our lives. And that's just a good example of it, is when fear arises. Yeah, thank you. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. Great evening. And I'll sit in noble silence tonight.
Thank you. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here. your question of how, you know, anatta and impermanence and dukkha, how my awareness of those things is I realize it's again, it's as with most things, it's a slow process. Mm-hmm. You're catching glimpses in the beginning, but it is growing. You know, even 2 years ago, that would have gone out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, I realize how close it was. But yeah, even when I was in it, I didn't consciously, I wasn't applying the Dhamma, but instinctively I was.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting my ego out of it, and then I had to get my fear out of it. And once that happened, then I could actually start being there and being in the moment.
Yeah.
And not thinking of what could happen in the future or what has happened in the past.
And getting your mind back changed everything.
Yeah, and I was, and it, in a way, it went back to the Metta Sutta. There cannot be any ill will,
Okay. Because
it gets in the way.
Yeah. Remarkable, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Mary, good to see you. How are you?
Good. Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Just a lot to absorb. Things certainly I've heard before, but in different ways and in different experiences. I can see myself operating in a way that is completely disconnected from understanding the three marks of existence and occasional ways that I am aligned and have clarity. So it's a work in progress.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. David, good to see you.
Thank you for your teaching. I have nothing to add.
Glad you're here. Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Yeah, it just, visual insights tonight about just the whole idea of unbinding. It's like each issue, it becomes like I'm tying a knot.
Mm-hmm.
And each time you untie a knot, maybe you discover another one, and so you tie that one, and it keeps deepening. So the layers of understanding keep deepening and integrating, and certainly hopefully that incorporating of employing that implement happens closer and closer to changing behavior, to changing.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Thank you. Liz, good to see you. How are you?
Good to see you. Good to be here. I recently had a confrontation with someone, and the best I could do was to stop talking and breathe.
That's pretty good.
But it didn't take away the second arrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that took a good couple of days to let that go. Because I rationalized that I had a hand in the disagreement, so what could I have done differently, kind of thing. But practice works.
Yeah. Thank you.
Even if it's 3 days later.
Yeah, better than not at all, though.
Yeah.
You know, and also that you understand and recognize the process.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, I mean, it's nice that it never happened or this, you know, but that the dukkha occurs, first noble truth. What are we going to do with it? You know, once it's occurred, if I want that to be different than it is, I'm just furthering my own suffering. But getting to the point of acceptance begins the process of letting it go and freeing. And not, and I would almost use the word healing, but it's not healing. You know, I mean, I guess you could call it healing, but it really is awakening. It's developing And using the proper definition of what awaken means, fully mature. You know, a fully mature person doesn't whine and moan about things that happens to it, does it?
But scientifically it does heal, because you're attending to certain parts of the central nervous system when you I mean, I could feel the adrenaline drop away when I took a breath and stopped talking.
Yeah, and you're so, right. It is healing that way.
Yeah, in that respect, yeah. It is healing. But it's also, you remember that feeling of things dropping away.
Yeah.
And if you remember that, you remember that as part of the practice, and you remember how to initiate it when it needs to be initiated.
You know, it reinforces and encourages you to
right.
come back to that way of thinking.
Because it feels better than,
yeah.
you know, a sharp stick in the eye.
Yeah. It leaves you disentangled from the world. Tomorrow,
my husband's always, that's one of his sayings, oh, it's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Yeah. The, a well-informed Dhamma practitioner who's fortunate enough to have a well-informed Sangha to be a part of develops contentment. That's really what the Buddha's talk. Tomorrow, the reason why I'm saying that is Thursday night's talk is on something called the Buddha Vaga. But it really, Buddha Vaga means the chapter on the Buddha, but it really means it describes, in the chapter, the Buddha describes what it means to be a Buddha. And he's describing ongoing, unprovoked contentment. And imagine having a mind like, I mean, you can all imagine that, can't you? Because you've had experiences of it. When you finally came to that resolution, there was some contentment there.
Yeah.
You know, and that is cultivated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the fear falls away, mm-hmm. first of all. Yeah. And the agitation falls away.
Yeah.
And that realization that you are now actually in the moment dealing with it. You're not dealing with the future.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with the past.
Yeah, and so contentment then isn't something that we get because we get something. Mm-hmm. Contentment is something that we get because we understand something. Mm-hmm. We understand three marks of existence. And it frees us. Great. So we're going to continue this next week. Yeah, this is a new sutta, so it's not in the chapter, but I'll send it out in Monday's email. We'll get a chance, and then we're going to finish this with the Dukkha Sutta. Then next, after that, we'll go spend 2 or 3 weeks on dependent origination and 5 clinging aggregates. After that, we're done. We're awakened, and we can.
Oh, I can't wait.
I have fear.
Better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Yeah, that's right.
It is.
I think we should put that up on the wall somewhere.
So, this is, we're going to do metta. These are the Buddha's words on metta, and he said, this is better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Way better.
I remember the day the Buddha said, this is better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Listen, Ananda. All right, let's finish this. Find your relaxed meditation posture, gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you,
John. Thank you, James. Thank you, Nick.
Good night, John.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.